This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. My name is H.F. Mason. I'm a general surgeon and chief medical officer at Baptist Memorial Hospital DeSoto and chief quality officer for the Baptist system.
And I'm Amanda Comer. I'm a nurse practitioner and the system director for advanced practice providers.
Well, guys, today you're in for a treat because on our podcast we have as our guest Dr. Jake Lancaster. Many of you will recognize Dr. Lancaster. He's also one of the hosts of our podcast, Connecting the Dots. But today he is actually a guest. And one thing that we're going to do is that I've always wanted to do is, you know, unravel this mystery of who exactly is Jake Lancaster. But in all seriousness, Jake serves as our chief medical informatics officer for the Baptist system. He is an internal medicine physician, a very smart internal medicine physician. He is not only a colleague, but he's also, I like to call him, a good friend. So, Jake, welcome to the podcast as a guest. And tell us just a little bit about your background.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. You know, I was able to worm my way in. I do know the host of the podcast, so I was lucky enough to get a spot.
You had an inside angle.
I had an inside. Yeah, it's good to know Skip and have his cell phone number. No, but in all seriousness, this will be interesting. I've never been on this side of things, so I'll do my best. But yeah, so I grew up in Mississippi. I went to Ole Miss, as listeners may know from our previous discussions, for both undergrad and med school. Ended up doing internal medicine residency at UAB. And it was there kind of I pivoted a little bit. I'd always been interested in leadership. I had been our medical school's student body president. And then in residency, I decided to get a master's in health administration while I was there. And I had always thought I was going to be a cardiologist, always really wanted to go down that road. But it was kind of during that master's in health administration that I discovered the IT side of things, and ended up being a fellow at Vanderbilt, being their first clinical informatics fellow. At some point, I had the crazy notion that I was still going to go to cardiology fellowship afterwards, but kind of fell in love with the work. And from there, went on to be a chief medical information officer at West Tennessee Healthcare, and then came to Baptist as our CMIO. And I've been here for about 4.5 years, I'm also the chief medical officer for the Baptist Medical Group. So I still like seeing patients. I had the opportunity to develop our virtual clinic, which is going strong now, and which Amanda also sees patients in, and just love building new things and continuing to grow the system as best I can.
You know, I just learned something new. So you actually got your MHA during your internal medicine residency.
Yeah.
Did you do it at the same time, or did you do 2 years and take a break, or?
No, so I did it my second and third year. They were very nice to work with me, and I ended up not having to use all my vacation days for it either. They let me do it on some of my easier electives, but there was a precedent before me. One of Dr. Kennedy had done it. She was a med-peds resident, had done it maybe 5 years before me. So it was good. It was hard, but the administration was very supportive in allowing me to do it.
You mentioned that during your MHA, you got interested in informatics. Did you grow up liking computers? Were you a computer guy? And, you know, I know all the young guys play computer games now, but I mean, but did you build computers? Yeah. Did you know how to write code and do things like that?
No, not at all. So I was probably that house tech guy though. So, if we got a new gadget, they would always get me to hook it up and get it going. So when my dad did get a laptop for the first time, I was the person to do it, despite I was the youngest one in the family. But I just had a way of maybe figuring things out and getting things going. I'm always the one to hook up the new DVD player to the TV and show them how to do that. But I didn't really get into IT really until after residency. I mean, I was a physics major in college, and as part of my thesis project, had done a little bit of programming, but very, very, very little. And so that was completely new to me. Yeah.
Well, so in addition, you know, he's CMO, CMIO, podcast host, and now an author of a new book. So tell us, you know, what really sparked your interest to write a book?
Yeah. So early on, I've always had an interest in writing. So even when I was in middle school and high school, I toyed with the idea. And my dad had written a book, that came out actually before I was born, that kind of inspired me to do the same. But I didn't really do anything with it until residency. So I was doing that master's in health administration. Started thinking about the healthcare system in a different way. And for those that are listening, I have no idea what we're talking about. The book's called The Matter of Medicine. It is a modern retelling of the King Arthur story, where he is, instead of a knight that goes on to found Camelot, he's a young doctor that embarks on a transformation of the healthcare system. So the idea for it kind of came up during my master's in health administration. I think one of the breaks I'd been on, I was at the beach and reading T.H. White's famous book, The Once and Future King, which is my favorite book after reading it at that time. And which is another retelling of the King Arthur myths. But I started thinking about how hospitals are like a lot like castles. They're both really, really large buildings and with a lot of specialized equipment inside of them. And instead of the knights, you have your doctors. And I was like, oh, this is a very interesting analogy. And I wanted to see how far I could take it. And I didn't do anything with it while I was in residency, didn't start writing it then, but then I was in fellowship. I had a little bit more time. It was less clinically demanding. And I remember what sparked me actually sitting down to write it was I was on Twitter and there was
it's called X now, by the way.
Oh, it's called X. You're right. But it's going to be a very hard habit to break calling it X instead of Twitter. But there was somebody that I followed on there had retweeted some publishing company that was offering, I think it was 2 weeks at some kind of remote English countryside house. If you submitted a prompt and won for like the best story or something. So you would tweet at them and offer your story and see if you would win. And I thought that sounded great, to be able to go spend 2 weeks in England and write it. Unfortunately, I did not win, but I submitted the idea and started really writing a little bit of it at a time. So I started writing at that point in fellowship, and that was a while ago. So it took me a while to actually get it published, but that was the inspiration for writing it.
I really like the book because you sort of meld the fantasy side, and I assume that you grew up reading fantasy or enjoying fantasy. I don't know if you read Lord of the Rings or the Harry Potter books or whatnot, but
all
also, but also you tie in. Yeah. I mean, you bring a lot of medicine into it that, is really appealing to clinicians, because that's the stuff that we do every day. And we understand what you're talking about. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, definitely grew up reading all of those. And so there's a lot that is stolen from them. But really, the entire plot and structure is taken from, the original kind of King Arthur story, the classic La Morte d'Arthur, The Death of Arthur, written by Thomas Malory. And so each of the chapters was kind of just outlined based on that original thing. And I just translated into healthcare. But yeah, I loved Lord of the Rings, loved all the Harry Potter series and The Hobbit and everything. I've read them several times. So big inspiration for a lot of what I put in there.
Now, wait, I have to ask this. Somebody who truly loves The Lord of the Rings, have you read the Silmarillion?
Just twice.
Oh, yeah, only twice. Yeah. See, I got about 20 pages into it, and then I just had to put it down.
No, I read it. I read that one. And actually, my senior year of high school, you know, we had to do like our big term paper. I did it on The Hobbit. So, yeah.
Okay.
I was very familiar with it, and it just seemed like a natural thing to blend into healthcare. You know, a lot of these stories, you know, if you think about Sherlock Holmes and House, you know, I thought, why can't I take another classic storyline and move it into healthcare? And the thing I like a lot about it is everybody knows all the problems we have in healthcare. We've talked about them on this podcast many times, and there's a lot of great people out there working on ways to improve it, you know, ourselves included. But it is just so much easier to be able to create it with the pen, you know, and design and create your own future. All the obstacles kind of melt away. So that's why I liked having fiction instead of nonfiction for this, just because kind of create the future in healthcare that you want.
That's what's so interesting about the book Matter of Medicine. You know, there's humor, there's music, like music references, there's family dynamics, there's the familiar story, but there's also big healthcare topics, you know, that to unpack: unnecessary testing, financial challenges in healthcare. I heard the term Medicare fraud, you know, malpractice, technology, hierarchy. You know, there's some big conversations in there too that I think is very interesting, the way you weaved that into the story.
Yeah, it was all definitely on my mind as I was writing it. And even the title, The Matter of Medicine, my mom wanted me to change it. But it, you know, it has two different purposes. One is, you know, the entire collection of kind of the King Arthur mythology is called The Matter of Britain. So, you know, for those that are really nerdy into the King Arthur, I hope they got that reference. But, you know, so The Matter of Medicine is what I was trying to do there, but also, you know, conjures up what's the matter with medicine. And that's another way that I wanted to tie it in. But
okay,
that's where the title comes from. And you'd have to be a pretty big Thomas Mallory nerd to get that one.
That is very interesting. Well, Skip is not on the podcast, but I think he would be upset if, you know, a lot of this podcast is dedicated to continuous improvement, process improvement. Talk to us a little bit about the whole process of writing. You know,
yeah,
a ton of us, most of us, at some point in our life or career, we say, gosh, I really would like to write a book, but none of us ever do. If I wrote a book, it would have to be, you know, like, it would have to be like The Old Man and the Sea, Ernest Hemingway, because I can write just simple short sentences. But tell us a little bit about the process. Did you have an outline? Did you map it out? Did you know how you wanted it to finish? And, you know, the process of getting to that point. Talk to us a little bit about that. How many different iterations did you have?
Yeah, it's a great question. Certainly learned a lot while writing it, as many of the other authors that have come on have talked about. And there is just a lot of nuance that goes into writing and how you can do it. What I did was I created an outline, broke it down based on the chapters, like I said, and Mallory's work, and then just began creating details for each one, creating, you know, taking the characters from the old work and translating them to something new, kind of giving descriptions for them. And then once I had a fairly detailed outline, and I didn't know how it was going to end, because I wanted to end kind of the same way that the classic one did, I started writing each chapter. So I would write chapter one, and I would write for 15 to 30 minutes every morning, really just Monday through Friday during the week. And that's the reason it's taken me, you know, half a decade or more to do it, is I didn't have that 2 weeks where I could go just sit in England to write. And then some days I would write a lot, some days I would write a little. Some days I wouldn't write at all. But, you know, the more you could get on the page, the better. And not worrying about if it's perfect that first time you write it, but just to get the big elements correct. So I did that. I don't remember how long ago it was where I finally got to where I thought it was complete and I had a draft. I mean, it's over a year and a half, maybe 2 years. I probably had something I thought was complete. And then I, you know, shopped it out to some people that would read and give me feedback on it, and then rewrote it based on that. And then also, you know me, I like my gadgets. I used a program called Grammarly to go through and correct all the grammar, because I didn't have a professional editor to do that at the time. And so but it wouldn't take the entire manuscript at a time. You had to break it up into little chunks and feed it through.
So you had the free version of Grammarly and not the paid version?
No, I'm kidding. I ended up going to the paid version, but it was, it still wouldn't ingest the whole work because, it was over 90,000 words, which was what I had discovered was kind of the magic number for something that of this genre to be published. So I fed it through that and got number of new things I needed to go back and change. And, you know, that process probably took me 6 months to do as well. And then I opted to pay an editor to go through and read it and give me very big structural feedback. And she gave me great feedback. Unfortunately, some of it was, she gives some thought of rewriting it and doing this X, Y, and Z. And at that point, I was 5 or 6 years into it. And I took some of the suggestions and reworded them and put them out there. But it was at that point, I thought I was done with what I had put down and wanted to move on. So that was kind of in March of last year when I did that. And then over the next. So, I was done. I had what I thought to be a final manuscript at that point. But I still didn't publish it in September just because there's so much stuff that you have to do to get it set up, to publish on Amazon, et cetera, that you just don't realize. You got to go find copyrights. You got to do all these other things with registering and then formatting it in the way that Amazon would want it, which was different than the Word document that I had. And so all of these little things add up and just take a lot of time. Even before I tried to make it into an audiobook.
Yeah, so the book's available on Amazon in print, but also accessible in an audiobook through Audible and other platforms. So tell us a little bit about that process.
Yeah, so it's, I guess, available in four formats now. It's hardback, paperback, as an ebook or on Kindle, and then as an audiobook. Which each one you have to kind of format a little bit differently. And I had to use different things to get the artwork cover done. They do have some tools to help you kind of design that. But that I used Midjourney. If you've heard of that, app it's an artificial intelligence, engine that will create images for you. So I took the cover of it. If you look at it, it has the rod of Asclepius. You might be familiar with in medicine. And I used it to kind of reimagine that and something that would befit King Arthur in medicine. So that was kind of my first use of some of that artificial intelligence. And then for the audio, very, very few works of fiction or anything on Amazon actually have audio available for them. You can go through the process of submitting it and finding a actual trained narrator to do that. But I never really wanted to go that route. I wanted it to kind of be my own voice. And luckily, there's all these new cool programs out there, and I like a good cool program. So I used something called 11 Labs to clone my voice And then I essentially fed it my book, and it produced the audio for it. So the process for doing that I thought was going to be really quick. So I think I started cloning my voice in November of 2023, and the actual cloning was not completed until mid-January. So
you started when?
I think it was either the first week in December or last week in November. But essentially, the way you do it is, I mean, there's several different ways. I thought I could just take all the audio that I produced from these podcasts over the years and feed it into that, and it would clone my voice based on that. But they recommended actually using. They didn't like that for audiobook recordings. So what I ended up doing was reading for an hour my book to 11 Labs, and it would take that audio and it creates my voice from it. And you can go in and tweak it a little bit, make it do different things. But yeah, so after about a month or more, I had a clone my voice, which I still have, and I can use, you know, for subsequent audiobooks if I end up getting there. But
does it sound does it sound just like you?
So it my
does. You've heard it, Amanda.
Amanda says it does, but my wife and kids didn't think so, which I thought it sounded like me. But I don't. Yeah. I don't know why my wife and kids don't think it sounds like me. Maybe I'm not yelling enough in it.
I had no idea that you could actually clone your voice. I guess that's kind of cool. I don't know. Maybe it's kind of
cool.
Scary.
A little creepy. You know, certainly there's all these issues with, you know, for like famous actresses or actors and politicians, illegal cloning of voices. And using it for scams. So that's a big issue out there. But I don't think my voice carries quite that weight yet.
Tell me a little bit about, I'm just interested, when you know, when you were developing your characters and in the book, did you ever find yourself asking, okay, what would Arthur do in this situation, or what would Dr. Ector do, or whoever, you know?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's how you should write it, is you kind of create the characters and put them in a situation and then decide how the character will act based on his or her personality. That's what a lot of the good ones do. I did not do that every time. I kind of took what had occurred really in the old, the original King Arthur stories. And that's why sometimes it might feel kind of out of character for Arthur to do things in my book, just because that was kind of how it happened in the past. But I did try to modernize it a little bit and make him a little bit more relatable.
It's interesting. So really, past experiences, did you bring those into the book as you were writing your own?
Yeah.
Past experiences.
Yeah, there was, obviously names and places are changed to protect the innocent, but there's, obviously a lot of me in the book, a lot of some of the clinical, especially the clinical encounters that I saw or cases that I had showed up there in various ways.
I mean, and you know, some of the And maybe frustrations and barriers and things that we face as clinicians, you know, that's what I was asking that same question, Amanda, when I was reading it. I was like, well, gosh, I've experienced this. So obviously Jake's got to be talking about personal experience for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing in there that is really Baptist, because most of this, you know, like, again, I started it when I was in fellowship. So a lot of it's more my residency experiences. Were kind of closer to home at the time when I was writing it. So, you know, the layout of the hospital is very similar to the layout of the hospital when I was training. And some of the things that happened on the first day that actually happened to me, where I was rounding on a patient, it might not have been my exact first day of my intern year, but it was the first week or two where I was the first person to pass by one of the private patient's rooms when he started coding, and I was the first one in the scene, and I had that deer in the headlights look. And then luckily our senior resident came in right behind me, 2 minutes later, but you know, that nurse looking at me, and I was very, very green intern, being expected to run a code, and had never seen it done before. That was drawn from real life for sure.
Oh yeah. We've all had those experiences. Finishing this book, did it inspire you to write a sequel or write another book, or are there more books about Arthur in the future, or maybe a different direction?
Yeah, so I have a few. So my second book, which I had come up with the idea way before I'd finished this one, was a retelling of a Peter Pan story. So I'm currently working on that one, and it may be another 5 years before it's out. But I've gotten in, a few chapters in already. But it's instead of him never growing up, he's a perpetual medical student trapped in the Neverland unit.
that's going to be a psychological thriller.
Yeah. Hook's a surgeon, as of course he would be. And Peter's, he's a medical student, but he leans more internal medicine. So the good guys versus the surgeons, as you would expect. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I told you this, Jake. I was originally wanted to be a cardiothoracic surgeon, and I wanted to go to Duke and do a decade with David Sabiston. So that's kind of what it would be like, because they'd say a lot of people, you went to residency at Duke and you never got out. You'd go into the lab and Dr. Sabiston he would never ever let you come out of the lab. So you were never able to finish.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, I hear that, I'm hearing rumors, don't know if they're true, but that maybe for the film version, maybe Timothy Chalamet and maybe Jennifer Lawrence. I think they're talking to them, discussions.
Yeah, they're in talks. Yeah. You know, it is funny. So as a good mom, she's probably my biggest proponent, but also her sister is, they're essentially my PR team for this outside of Skip. And they have somebody, some producer in Mississippi that they're trying to get to do something with it. And so they're optimistic, but I'll wait until the casting calls come around.
That's awesome. Well, Jake, we're approaching the 30-minute mark, and I'm just really want to commend you. I'm proud of you, because you've done something that a lot of us would like to do, but none of us can't do, and it's quite a feat. And I wish you much success. I hope you sell a million copies, and I can see in the future, like Michael Crichton, wrote all the Jurassic Park books as a physician. So but once again, thank you for being here, and good luck.
Well thank you, HF. And since I am the guest, I like being able to get the last word. You mentioned that you wanted, everybody wants to do it. All you got to do is take that first step and start writing a little bit every day, and eventually it adds up. That's what it did for me.
All right. Good words of wisdom. Thank you, everybody. And we'll see you guys on the next show.
Thank you.